Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moscone. It wasn't a surprise, but to many, it felt like a shock just the same. Last Friday, the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade, the decision that legalized abortion nearly 50 years ago. The conservative majority voted to overturn Roe, with Chief Justice John Roberts rendering something of a split decision. He agreed with the majority on upholding the Mississippi abortion restriction at hand, but wrote a second opinion arguing that Roe v. Wade should not have been overturned. In the end, it didn't matter. The numbers simply weren't there. The decision, of course, set off a flurry of activity. Many states started enacting new abortion restrictions immediately, while others started preparing for an anticipated onslaught of new patients who would be crossing state lines for the procedure. Some celebrated, while others took to the streets in protest.
We're here to say, this decision must not stand!
This decision must not stand!
Legal abortion across the land!
Legal abortion across the land!
Pro-choice, that's the law! Babies never choose to die! Pro-choice, that's the law! Babies never choose to die!
We did it!
And we should mention that that sound comes courtesy of the Washington Post and Reuters. Of course, over the weekend, Democratic strategists crafted messaging for the midterm elections, while Republicans sought to turn voter attention back to the economy. And many wondered whether the fall of Roe was the beginning of the end of other personal freedoms, like the right to same-sex marriage. So what happens now, and where do we go from here? Our guests are Kimberly Mutcherson, co-dean and law professor at Rutgers University Law School, Camden. She is an award-winning professor whose scholarship focuses on reproductive justice, bioethics, and family and health law. Kimberly, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
And also joining us is Rachel Ribouchet, interim dean and professor of law at Temple University Beasley School of Law. She is a leading scholar in reproductive health law, feminist legal theory, and family law. Rachel, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, to our listeners, you can add your voice to the conversation by tweeting us at WHYY Radio Times, emailing us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or calling 888-477-9499. That said, Kimberly Mutcherson, let me begin with you, and let's just level set. What, in a nutshell, did the Supreme Court say in its ruling?
It said pretty much what we saw in the leaked opinion. I mean, there was really no effort to to buttress that, even though there was time to do so. So unequivocally overruled Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, sent the issue back to the states for them to make their own decisions, said that any new statutes that regulated abortion would be subjected to the lowest level of constitutional scrutiny. So in other words, the easiest level of scrutiny to be able for a state to actually successfully pass legislation. So we're in a whole new world right now.
Yeah. And Rachel Ribouchet, how many states already have or soon will have anti-abortion laws on the books? Because there were those trigger laws that were set up to go into effect as soon as Roe v. Wade went down.
Sure. So there were 13 states with trigger laws. They varied, though, in what had to happen in order to put the law into effect. But Missouri, for instance, first out of the gate to put its trigger law into action the day that Dobbs came down and that Roe v. Wade was overturned. Most people predict that at the end of a process in which states will enact laws that ban abortion or almost all abortion early in pregnancy or at differing points in pregnancy, about 26 states will have those laws. So over half the country will ban almost all abortion, and most of them early in pregnancy.
And where would the most restrictive laws be at this point? Would that be Texas?
So I think it depends. Alabama has a very strict law because it is a law that doesn't have any exceptions. Texas does have a medical emergency exception as under SB 8. Other states have exceptions for health and life. Most states have exceptions for emergency medical situations and many for life, less so for health and less so for sexual assault, fetal abnormality or anomaly. So that's the range of exceptions you can expect to see in the 26 states that are going to take a more active role in limiting abortion.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and the bans can be anywhere. I mean, some of them are 6 weeks, some of them are 15 right. weeks. So we'll see how all of that shakes out as well.
And I think only one is 15 weeks at this point. But most are 6 weeks and, or below.
Yeah.
So most women might not even know they were pregnant at 6 weeks. And then the health question, Kim, is murky as well, I would think, for a clinician, because it doesn't sound like it's clear when we're in emergency territory, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there are sort of two issues when it comes to health. So one is a medical emergency, and that's the space where I think a lot of healthcare providers are going to feel a little wary of just how close to death somebody has to be before you intervene. But then there's also a broader health exception, right, which used to be required under Roe and Casey and is not now. So you know, I think that's a place where we're going to see some litigation, right? So life and health of the pregnant woman used to be required under the Constitution. So, you know, it could be not that you're about to die right now, but that if you stay pregnant for the next 2 months. And that's not a medical emergency, but it's certainly a set of health circumstances where people would want to be able to provide an abortion. So there's just a lot that is unclear right now about what states are going to do, about what prosecutors are going to do, because we've already seen some progressive prosecutors say that they will not prosecute people for providing abortions. So this is going to be a very wild ride.
Yeah.
And so, Rachel, that leads to the question about the protections that do remain in democratically led states primarily at this point. What protections do remain and how are states now mobilizing to try to protect the rights that do exist?
So in the other half of the country, there's a very different picture. Different set of events are unfolding. So you have a handful of states that are actively legislating to protect abortion providers and the patients in their states and patients that travel to their states seeking legal abortion care. New York passed a law, Connecticut passed a law, and the purpose of California just signed a law, and the purpose of these laws, they're being called shield laws, is anticipation of an influx of patients who are traveling from other places who need either medication abortion, the two-drug regimen that the FDA has approved until 10 weeks of pregnancy, or procedural abortion through telehealth or at brick-and-mortar clinics, to protect those patients coming into the state and, frankly, to protect the providers in the state. There's been we've seen early signs that states like Missouri might try to not just ban abortion within their borders, but stretch their abortion policies past their borders. And some of these laws are anticipation of that, protecting providers from being extradited to other states if they're charged criminally for providing a legal abortion in New York for an for a Missouri resident or citizen. Countersuits, if they get sued civilly, they can countersue for damages. The state refusing to participate in investigations or comply with subpoenas or the like. So that is another complexity because states are really, they're legislating not just to protect providers and support patients who are traveling to their states, but also to send a message that if there's a spectrum of abortion rights, support and prohibition, we are on the side of support. But it's worth emphasizing that along that spectrum, there are going to be states like our own, that don't rush to ban abortion straight away, that don't have a trigger law or a pre-Roe law or a constitutional amendment yet,
right.
But are not going to rush to repeal the restrictions on the books. So the legal landscape gets even more complicated because it's not just about banning or permitting. There will be states that still have waiting periods, informed consent, provider requirements, so on and so forth. So it's I'm going to echo Dean Murchison. It's going to be a little bit wild, Wild West.
Well, the confusion reigns, certainly, because no one really has a clear idea of how all of this plays out. Kim, already one judge has blocked a trigger law from actually two, I guess, in two states, Utah and Louisiana, at least temporarily. They're keeping some of those trigger laws from going into effect. Do you think that we're going to see a lot more of that? And also, we're hearing about lawmakers turning to state constitutions and sort of reviewing them to see what protections might be contained therein that could buy some time.
Mm-hmm. I just want to give all praise and shout outs to the lawyers who were just ready to go. And so that's why we have laws that are already blocked, because they were ready to go into court as soon as the Dobbs decision came down. So that's wonderful. And then, you know, the issue of state constitutions is going to be absolutely critical here. You know, the federal constitution gives us a whole series of rights, but our state constitutions in some cases can be equally as important, in large part because they can provide often broader rights than the federal constitution. So, for instance, some states have a specific right to privacy in their constitution, or some states have an equal rights amendment, right, which we never managed to pass on the federal level. They have those in their state constitution. So if the federal government and the Supreme Court are not going to be helpful in this regard, then people are going to look to their state laws.
Yeah. Rachel, you mentioned just a moment ago the abortion pill. And is that, as you see it, sort of the next frontier in all of this, where if women are unable to, you know, have an abortion in a clinic or in sort of a medical environment, that we'll see much more, far more requests for that, and then questions around whether pills can be mailed and efforts to block access to those pills?
So, yes, I think that medication, abortion pills, those pills are going to play a big role in the access landscape moving forward. So just a couple of things that I think are happening up against Dobbs and the new slate of bans that we see. So in December of last year, the FDA lifted a rule, a restriction on medication abortion that required patients to pick up the pills at a healthcare facility. And this cleared the way for an ongoing experiment that had really taken root during the pandemic, when a court had suspended that same FDA rule, allowing certified providers to mail the pills to patients. So virtual clinics have cropped up. These clinics offering telehealth for abortion. You can have synchronous, asynchronous counseling, screening, followed by pills being mailed to you. And I just give you this background to say that that creates a lot of different possibilities for where providers are and where patients are. So, yes, pills can be mailed. If a state bans abortion, it bans all abortion. It's not going, it's banning surgical, procedural, as well as medication abortion. So under how current law is structured, if you're going to have telehealth for abortion, if you're going to have pills mailed to you, legal advice is that you need to be in a state that allows it. Yeah. But there are possibilities for travel and cross-border care that telehealth eases.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought, because we have to take a break in just a moment. We're talking about the fall of Roe v. Wade and what the implications of that will be for reproductive health and other things. Radio Times will be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we are talking, of course, about the fall of Roe v. Wade last week and the implications of that for reproductive health, as well as for privacy, for the midterm elections. There are many, many questions that have been raised since that ruling, and we are doing our best to tackle as many of them as we can this hour. Our guests are Kimberly Mutcherson, who is co-dean and professor of law at Rutgers Law School in Camden, and Rachel Ribouchet, who is interim dean and professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. We welcome Your questions and comments for our guests, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 888-477-9499. I want to just read a few listener comments that have come in since we began our conversation. We have an email from Paul who says, a 14-year-old girl can't legally adopt a baby, and yet she is now forced to give birth to one. The Supreme Court majority, he says, he calls them corrupt. Another listener tweets, seven judges approved Roe, at least five more supported it in Casey. How do five now overrule the 12? Hard to acknowledge SCOTUS as legitimate with these kinds of rulings. And perhaps later we'll talk a little bit about confidence in the court as some of these decisions come down. But I do want to talk about privacy concerns in the wake of all this. When we took our break, we were talking about access to abortion pills, and that raises questions about privacy. I saw at least one article, Kim, that explained how to seek an abortion without leaving a digital trail, and I thought, my goodness, what a sign of the times that is. Can you address how privacy issues are likely to arise out of this and kind of what the, you know, landmines could be there?
Yeah, I mean, this sort of goes along with what Rachel was saying about medication abortion, which is if you want to, you know, quote unquote, catch someone who's having a medication abortion, there might have to be some significant surveillance that's involved in trying to figure out who that person is. So being able to track the people who sell, being able to track the people who purchase, depending upon how it is sent, potentially being able to actually, you know, get warrants and open mail, you know, these are things that are, I would think, deeply problematic to lots of us. And then even putting all of that aside, you know, think about how much data lots of us sort of put out into the world, right? Whether it's a period tracker on your phone. And there was lots of information going around this weekend saying, if you've got a period tracker on your phone, get rid of it now and get rid of the data. So, you know, there is this sense of, in order for states to be able to do what they really want to do, right, which is sort of criminalize as many abortions as possible, you're also going to have to be able to pierce the veil of privacy for lots of folks.
And Rachel, how much protection does HIPAA offer to patients?
So HIPAA is a federal statute that protects patients' private information. I think there's a post-ops country where there's confusion, this would be one thing that I think the federal government could play a proactive role in helping educate healthcare providers about what their HIPAA responsibilities are. HIPAA protects your patient information, so a healthcare provider cannot turn over your private health information to law enforcement unless they have a subpoena or a legal document that instructs them to do so. And so I just mentioned the role of agencies like HHS in spreading information because, as Kim mentions, you know, as there's confusion about what's allowed and what's not allowed, and providers are rightly nervous about being afoul of a new law that has no agency to tell them what to do or how to interpret exceptions, or those are in process or in progress, there's a fear that there will be both misunderstandings about what their duties are to patients, both in terms of health privacy and a theme that came up earlier in providing emergency care. So they are also federally required under a law called EMTALA to provide emergency care to patients who present. And that includes treating people who are miscarrying, who have ectopic pregnancy. And we've already seen that there's a lot of confusion there, too, about whether or not it is illegal for a ER doc, for instance, to treat a patient within it whose life is threatened, but they are not close to death because they have an ectopic pregnancy. So, sorry to go down that road again, but it's HIPAA is like the EMTALA questions, where there just needs to be more information for folks about what their legal duties are.
And it does raise the question about if someone comes in with a miscarriage, could that look suspect, right? That maybe this was a pill-induced abortion.
So there was a recent case of someone who had a stillbirth at home and sought care when asked about it, was investigated, and the fact that she had Googled abortion pills, mifepristone, misoprostol, how to order misoprostol in particular from other sources, was used against her, in suspecting her of inducing her own terminating her pregnancy when it was in fact a stillbirth.
Yeah. Kimberly, who's going to be hit hardest by this ruling?
The people who are most vulnerable, right? So women of color, low-income women, women in rural communities, younger women who tend to find out about their pregnancies later. These are all the folks who have already been hit hardest, right? I mean, the states have been curtailing abortion access since at least 1992 under Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and even before then. So if you were living 200 miles from a clinic, and now you're going to live 600 miles from a clinic, you know, that it's just going to be hard for people to marshal the resources that they need. Most women who have abortions already have children at home. So now if you have to travel for a few days, you have to get childcare. If it takes you longer to get the resources together, it's going to cost you more to have the abortion and also will increase the risk of the procedure. So, you know, there are all these sorts of things that are going to happen as a consequence. And then, of course, there are the women who will give birth, right? They will not be able to access abortions. And one of the points that I have been continually making, because I think it's really important, is putting aside whatever concerns you might have about women trying to self-abort and unsafe abortions. Women are going to die because they're forced to stay pregnant. This country has one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world. Mississippi has the highest maternal mortality rate in this country. And these are the places that are banning access to abortion. So, and then there's a racial disparity as well. Black women are 2 to 5 times more likely to die as a consequence of pregnancy and childbirth than are white women. So, again, putting aside whatever concerns you have about unsafe abortion, women are going to die because they're forced to stay pregnant.
Yeah. I want to talk about the political implications of this a little bit. And I know that both of you are attorneys, but we want to talk about the midterm elections and you know, how all of this could impact those elections. And Rachel, I'll start with you, whether you think that this ruling is going to galvanize people to get to the polls. There has been talk about, you know, voters are distracted by inflation and all of these other issues that we're dealing with currently. How do you think that this will impact November?
I'm an eternal optimist. I think that if I think on either side of the question, people are galvanized and they understand the importance of turning out to the vote. I think if you are supportive of abortion rights, there's a lot happening. There's a lot happening in terms of political mobilization to get people to think about how they can influence the influence future legislation by the votes they cast this fall. I worry that there has been a lot of vote dilution and gerrymandering and other, frankly, other impediments to having voting numbers translate into election outcomes. But that said, I think that this last weekend we saw a nation very divided in terms of its protests and celebrations. And, if people turn out to the polls based on, if that energy is any indication about what people will do in the fall when they vote, that would be heartening to me because it would signal to me that people are re-engaging and engaging with our electoral process.
Yeah, and since we're here in Pennsylvania, one of the reasons why the Pennsylvania state legislature might not be moving so quickly is they have a Democratic governor who has said very clearly, I will veto all of those bills, right? But we have an election coming up. So, I think that there are a lot of folks, particularly where those margins are very tight, if this is something that you care about, this is not an election to sit out.
Well, and as a follow-up to that, Kim, in talking about Pennsylvania, it seems that the Pennsylvania governor's race now becomes even more critical because we've got Josh Shapiro on the one hand, a Democrat. We've got Doug Mastriano on the other side, who has said, and I think the quote was, that he wanted to see Roe v. Wade, quote, rightly relegated to the ash heap of history. And so Pennsylvania becomes a key battleground in November.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, right? And you see, we also see it in the Senate race in Pennsylvania, because who's in Congress matters as well. So this is going to be, you know, the midterms are going to be a really interesting time. And, you know, one thing that I think is interesting in this context is that people on the right, and this is just based on, you know, research that has been done about attitudes and voting, will be willing to be one-issue voters, right? They'll say, I'm just voting for the person who is anti-choice, whereas people on the left, we often will have many, many issues that we are voting on. So, if this is not something that's sufficient to galvanize people, then, you know, we'll see what happens after the next election cycle. Yeah.
And Rachel, even Donald Trump, while taking credit for the decision that the Supreme Court handed down, said that the fall of Roe v. Wade will be bad for Republicans in the midterms. And there does seem to be some concern among Republicans, as we mentioned earlier, about sort of redirecting voter attention to the economy and to inflation. Do you think that Trump might be right about this? That it
No, well, so I think that
you're going to go on the record saying Trump is right.
I'm on the record. Trump is right. No, so I do think that it not only redirects attention to other issues, but I think that some of these legislative strategies are going to fail because some of these the laws that are being implemented now, and if you think about, for instance, laws that are contemplating passing legal personhood for the fetus, you know, life at conception with legal rights that follow. Those laws are not only going to be hard to implement, but they're going to have consequences that that legislators can't foresee. And I think that we should expect some surprises. I think some of those strategies are going to backfire. They're going to backfire both in terms of enforcement and implementation, but also in terms of human cost. I mean, again, maybe I'm, you know, but I think that what we, because the landscape is complex and because we don't know what happens next, this is not necessarily something that's going to work out for Republicans mm-hmm. in various yeah. states. In fact, it could backfire in key states. So I think we should expect surprises.
Well, I want to shift gears a little bit now and talk about the court itself and a little bit more about some of the questions that have arisen out of this. And in fact, Patty, one of our listeners, has the question that I was about to ask, which is, how likely is it that the Supreme Court will hand down decisions against gay marriage or relationships, contraception, even in vitro fertilization? Kimberly, what do you say to that?
So one thing that I want to just start off by saying is anybody who was in that camp of you're being so hysterical, there's no way that they're going to get rid of Roe, owes lots of us an apology. So I feel like we're in this space where kind of anything goes. At this point, I don't trust what the Supreme Court is willing to do. I don't trust that they see limits to what they can do. So I'm very concerned. So as Rachel was saying, you know, if we get states that are passing personhood laws, what does that mean for frozen embryos? You know, what happens when a state says that a frozen embryo is no different than a 10-year-old and needs to be treated the same way? The good thing about that is that it pulls in the fertility industry people and there's a little more power there. But still, you know, that's an issue. Issue that people aren't necessarily thinking about. And even though Justice Alito, who I don't, you know, do not trust as far as I could throw him, you know, Justice Alito says very clearly, oh, this is just about abortion. Definitely none of these other rights are at risk. And yet the reasoning of the opinion absolutely maps onto a bunch of other rights that are not enumerated in the Constitution and that are not a part of this nation's history and tradition, right? So if you think about going back to sort of what did the framers want, they didn't want any of us to vote, right? They didn't, those of us sitting in this studio, they didn't want us to be free, right? Those of us who are people who are black in the studio. So there's something really painful and concerning about that being the standard that we're going to use going forward. And, you know, I don't often say that I, you know, appreciate Clarence Thomas, but one thing that I do appreciate about what Justice Thomas did is he said, what's next, right? Obergefell, marriage equality is next. Griswold, access to contraception is next. Lawrence versus Texas, being able to have sex with the person who you want to have sex with and not have that criminalized. Those are three cases that Justice Thomas basically said, please bring these cases up to us because we are ready to send it back to the states. And that's where it gets risky. Not all rights need to be decided on a state level.
Yeah. And Rachel, your thoughts about that as well, because that has been something that many people have been talking about, is Clarence Thomas saying, well, wait a minute, you know, now maybe a lot of other things are up for grabs.
I think that, you know, I agree that Justice Thomas sees the trajectory of the type of reasoning that the majority opinion employs. So Justice Alito, as you know, just as Kim said, says no less than three times, this is just about abortion, this is just about abortion. The reasoning for why it's just about abortion is because marriage and contraceptives and sexual intimacy, those don't entail human life. So that for Alito, the difference, for Justice Alito, the difference is abortion has an inbuilt consideration for respect for preservation of potential life, and those do not. But that's not the test that he actually uses or employs to strike, to overturn Roe v. Wade. The test is this right rooted in history and tradition? And he goes back a long way in ways that would suggest that if I were to use the same test, there was criminalization of contraceptive use. There's potentially no history and tradition of access to birth control being a 14th Amendment due process right. So, you know, I think it's hard to square the test he uses and what he says are the limitations of the opinion.
Yeah. Kimberly, I have 30 seconds before I go to a break, but I just want to ask very quickly about whether, even though President Biden has indicated that he doesn't support this, does what happened on Friday strengthen the argument for expanding the court and or having term limits on justices quickly?
So I'm not a big expanding the court person, in part because I feel like it would just become this arms race, and that next thing you know, we have 50 people on the Supreme Court. That doesn't make sense. Term limits, I could see there. I think that there are some serious ethics questions that we should be talking about for Supreme Court justices. So I think there are definitely more conversations to be had about reforming the Supreme Court.
And more to be said about this topic. Radio Times will be back in just a moment. We are talking about the fall of Roe v. Wade. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we have been talking about the fall of Roe v. Wade last Friday. What are the implications for reproductive rights? What are the implications for the midterm elections? What are the implications for clinicians who provide those services to patients? So many questions that have come out of that ruling, and people are scrambling to figure out what exactly it is going to mean. We have got a pair of experts in the studio with us to help us sort through all of those questions. Our guests are Rachel Ribouchet, who is interim dean and professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. Also with us is Kimberly Mutcherson, who is co-dean and professor of law at Rutgers Law School in Camden. We have been talking about many issues, but one of the things, Kimberly, that we have not talked about yet is the legal risks for employers, because there are those employers, Citigroup, Dick's Sporting Goods, and some others, who have decided that they will pay travel expenses for employees who have to go out of state for abortions. Can you explain why some companies elected to do that and what potential legal exposure they may have now?
Well, I don't know that I can necessarily speak for the companies, except to say that, you know, based on the public statements that they've made, they support their employees being able to get access to reproductive health care. And if they can't do it where they live, then they'll help them get it elsewhere. So, you know, good for them. In terms of liability, you know, I think the thing that they need to be worried about are these states that are passing these aiding and abetting laws. So if, you know, you have a state that says not only are we either criminalizing or creating a structure of fines for people who perform abortions, we're also creating that structure for people who aid and abet abortions. Well, if you're paying for somebody to fly out of state in order to get an abortion, that looks like aiding and abetting. So we'll have to see what states decide to do about going after companies, particularly given that companies often bring an economic boost to a state. I'm not quite sure that you want to start scaring them off that way.
We also have a follow-up question from a caller who mentioned that we stated that the U.S., and this is going back to a conversation we had a few minutes ago, about the U.S. having the highest maternal mortality rate in the world, and was asking, could we clarify exactly that statement? Please clarify that it is a developed country. So can we just kind of clarify? I know one of you, I can't remember which one mentioned that.
It was me. I didn't say it had the highest. I said it has one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world for a developed nation. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. And certainly we have parts of this country where we rival developed nations in the number of, in the rate at which women die from pregnancy and childbirth. There's no reason why we should be as high as we are on any of these lists.
And you also mentioned, just again to clarify, that particularly for Black women, that the rate of maternal mortality is, I think, several times higher than for everyone else.
Yep.
Correct?
2 to 5 times. Yep.
As high.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So lots of other things to talk about. One is, you know, what is there that can be done by the White House? Some of the top stories today were saying that there are Democrats who are expressing impatience with the White House and wanting to see, you know, more aggressive activity as it relates to what happened on Friday. And so, Rachel, I'll start with you. But what recourse, what options might President Biden have at this point?
So I think there are a few options. And one of the fascinating, interesting parts of thinking about what happens next is the potential for interjurisdictional conflicts, the conflicts between states and the federal government that is sees its role as being on the side of meeting needs for abortion services or abortion access, stating, as the Biden administration has, that it disagrees with the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. So, but to your point, what happens next? So the Biden administration could do an audit of the various powers it has through the federal agencies to material support abortion care through vouchers. That's not a Hyde Amendment issue. If you're supporting travel or childcare or other logistical needs that patients who are traveling or are navigating new laws are seeking. What is it that each federal agency could do? Part of that, for instance, would be the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, thinking about through its powers how it restricts medication abortions. It has lifted some restrictions. Others remain. For decades, people have thought that those restrictions are unnecessary. They don't comport with how other drugs that are as safe or not as safe as mifepristone, the first drug in a medication abortion. So thinking through lifting those regulations. And then, quite frankly, any point where possible, asserting the power of the federal government where it has it to support abortion rights and access. So we saw Attorney General Merrick Garland do that, to say, you know, we will use the power of the Justice Department to promote and protect abortion rights where the federal government has a role to do so. One place where it has a role to do so is if state policy is contradicting federal drug policy in trying to ban a federally approved FDA compliant a drug from its market. So that's a preemption argument. It's a little bit It's a little novel. It's a little in the weeds, but there's a whole range of what's been suggested of how the Biden administration can intervene. Just very quickly to that point, Kim mentioned aiding and abetting laws, where that might trip up employers and catch corporations. Those laws exist or only are allowed to be implemented and enforced if states are permitted to attach their policies to people who are helping people receive legal abortions elsewhere. So these companies are funding legal abortions. You can't have the abortion in Texas, but the company is helping you travel to Kansas, to New Mexico. The Biden administration, through its law enforcement powers and through its interpretive powers, can make a strong statement about the role of federalism and the role of state cooperation to not impede interstate commerce and not to offend a right to travel among the states for these states who might be otherwise inclined to try to prohibit people from leaving or prohibit people from helping people leave.
Question here from Ruth. Actually, it's more of a comment in an email, who says, I am concerned that justices who are ruling against women's rights should not be able to. Kavanaugh and Thomas were accused of sexual harassment or assault. There is a general problem of men ruling about women's rights, but too clear, and this is the word she used, misogynists ruling in such a case is problematic. Your thoughts, Kimberly?
I hear that. I mean, I'm not one of those people who takes the position that, you know, men have nothing to say about abortion. I just don't think that's true. What I do think, though, and the critique that I have, not just for, Justice Thomas or for Justice Kavanaugh, but for Justice Barrett and Justice Gorsuch as well, is, you know, they sat in their confirmation hearings and they talked to the senators behind closed doors and, you know, said, you know, this is settled precedent and we know what the rules are and we believe in stare decisis and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And literally the first opportunity that they had, they overruled Roe versus Wade. So, you know, I think the questions about what is the purpose of a confirmation process, about the politicization of that process and the politicization of the court, you know, those are really serious concerns. And I think that a lot of people who in the normal course of events don't spend time thinking about the Supreme Court are going to be much more focused on it now than they were in the past.
Yeah. And Rachel, do you agree with that there will be renewed debate about the court? And we mentioned this very briefly earlier about confidence in the court, that there is a population of people in this country, and a large population, that would say that their confidence has been shaken in the high court.
I think there's a population of people who certainly have their confidence shaken in the court. The Senator Collins, for instance, said she was misled by Justice Kavanaugh during private conversations about his fidelity to precedent and to particularly to Roe v. Wade. But beyond the Senate confirmation hearings, which I think for a long while we have seen a somewhat scripted approach to how you answer certain questions, to pick up where Kim started, there's something really interesting to me that there is a crisis at the Supreme Court, a leaked draft of one of the most important decisions handed down, in the last number of years, is made public, which the holding didn't really shock me, but the fact that it was leaked did. And so that happens, and there's going to be an investigation, and we're going to find out who did it. We will never find out until, right, you know, some expose that turns into a Netflix documentary. But so that happens, and there is this groundswell of concern about what this majority opinion says. Frankly, its tone and the words it uses, it clearly has a message. There's a conversation for the last 6 weeks, and the opinion doesn't change one bit. It actually just adds paragraphs that are a takedown of the dissent and just the Chief Justice, well, a purported takedown of the dissent and the Chief Justice. And I only bring that up to say, here's a court who says, we will not buckle. We are not, we are doubling down.
Yeah.
we've heard the concerns about language and tone. Clearly, they're people who exist in the world. We understand the portions of this opinion that are dicta that you absolutely do not need to get to the holding that the court arrived at. You do not for 1 minute have to talk about the Equal Protection Clause in order to, and that equality is not a basis of abortion, to rule the way that the majority ruled. And yet, there it's still there. And so it's not that, you know, some people, I think, could rightly say, well, that shows that the court is not going to bow to peer, you know, the political pressure and public outcry. But it also, I think, to another set of people says, well, doesn't the court want us to understand their reasoning? Don't they want to translate their thinking, their arguments, so that we the people can understand what their values are as they interpret the Constitution, not their values as justices, but what they think the values of the Constitution are and should be. I'll stop.
And I think also just, you know, fidelity to intellectual honesty would be really nice. You know, these are very smart people, and, you know, they know that they're cherry picking history, right? I mean, and so I would prefer that they at least could be honest about what they're doing and why they're doing it, as opposed to, you know, engaging in this project of pretending to be doing one thing when they're doing something else. And that again, I think, leads to serious questions about the legitimacy of the court and those who are sitting on it right now.
Question from Shelley, who says, wouldn't small government conservatives favor a right to privacy? And this is going back to what we talked about a few minutes ago when we were having the whole discussion around privacy and how much protection is there for it. So Shelley's question, Kimberly, is wouldn't small government conservatives favor that, the right to privacy?
Yeah, except apparently when it comes to abortion. I mean, I think the other part of this conversation is a conversation about hypocrisy. You know, that on one hand, if you think about the rights that are protected by, that are unenumerated and that are protected by this sort of broader sense of privacy, you know, it's things like your right to procreate. It's things like your right to parent your children, right? So everybody who's homeschooling their kids, right, believes very deeply in the privacy of their home and their ability to make decisions about their children. And those are part of this sort of amorphous piece that is drawn from the Constitution. And so those rights apparently are okay. But then when we get to abortion and potentially contraception, which I think is next on the list, quite frankly, all of a sudden those are the interest of the state. So, you know, that's another place where I think a little intellectual honesty would be great.
Yeah. And you mentioned contraception. We talked about that briefly in an earlier part of the program, about that being one of the items that's up for grabs. And so the question is, you know, going forward, how should we be thinking about this as we watch what has happened on Friday, as we watch the states now scrambling to either strengthen abortion bans and restrictions or to protect rights? And this sort of question of, you know, contraception, same-sex marriage, these other personal rights that now could be up for grabs. What are you watching for? How should we be thinking about this now?
Well, one of the things that I think we need to be really cautious about is watching how states define abortion, right? So, for instance, if a state decides that any kind of contraception that potentially keeps a fertilized egg from implanting is no different than an abortion, then we're going to go after morning after pills, we're going to go after the IUD. And we already saw that in the Hobby Lobby case, which was the Affordable Care Act case, where, you know, part of the claim was, we don't want to cover these forms of contraception because we feel like they are basically agents of abortion. So I think that's one thing that we're going to have a lot of concern about, and have that concern very quickly.
Yeah. And Rachel, in our last few seconds, your thoughts about how we should be thinking about this. What are you looking for?
I think that I'm thinking a lot about the role of misinformation and confusion. The legal landscape is changing so quickly. And, you know, people need information about what their law says and what it provides and what does it restrict and what does it permit. And just the question of what's ahead, definitions matter, that communication matters. The people who are helping people navigate what is now a very complicated legal landscape, those people deserve some praise.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank both of you so much for being with us. Rachel Reboucher is Interim Dean and Professor of Law at Temple. Kimberly Mutcherson, Co-Dean and Professor of Law at Rutgers Camden. Thank you both so much for being with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Our producers on Radio Times are Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray, and our engineer today was Adam Staniszewski. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matysak, filling in for Marty Moscone.